Blog Talk Radio.
Special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
What's up? What's good, everybody? You are here on the February 17th episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show. I'm your host, James Bell, lead boxing analyst for the Cold Hard Truth on Sports. You can catch boxing articles and more at thechtonsports.com. Once again, that is thechtonsports.com. Number to dial in to talk boxing is 347-237-5539. That is 347-237-5539. Press the one key to get on cue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. So we got a few things to talk about here in this 1 hour live session. We have the fights that took place on Friday and Saturday night, including the fight that happened in the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles, the main event there with Leo Santa Cruz over Rafael Rivera. And you also, you know, had a cool feature bout there with Omar Figueroa Jr. against John Molina Jr. And I also wanted to, you know, touch a little bit on the fight that took place on Friday with Rob Brent defending his middleweight title against Kasan Basenguroff. So we're going to be going over those two fights in this episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show. If you wanted to, you know, have your take on what happened in those fights, then you're free to call in here. So I just wanted to start off with, you know, what happened on Saturday night. You had the PBC on Fox telecast held at the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles. You had the Leo Santa Cruz, of course, you know, had his lone loss to Carl Frampton before getting the win in the rematch to get the title back, going up against Rafael Rivera, who was coming in there with a record of 26 wins, 2 losses, and 2 draws. You know, Santa Cruz looked like he was, you know, preparing to fight Miguel Flores, but Flores had to pull out due to injury, so you had Rafael Rivera step in there to face Leo Santa Cruz to see if he could, you know, upset Leo Santa Cruz and win that WBA featherweight championship. Yeah, you have the, you know, these two guys basically going at it, you know, from the first round on. I think, you know, Rivera had a little bit of a good start there. It was just, you know, something where it was, you know, basically, I would say, you know, a typical Santa Cruz type of fight where he was very active in the ring, you know, throwing a lot of punches from, you know, the first round until round 12. had something there in the instance of, you know, I would say, you know, Santa Cruz, you know, just trying to see if he could outwork Rivera to see if he could tire him out and, you know, eventually try to take him out there, but I didn't necessarily, you know, quite work that way. Form. You had a game, you know, a game Rivera there in this particular fight. He didn't, you know, necessarily want to get there and be, you know, taken out, so to speak. But yeah, like I was saying, he had like a good first start, first couple of rounds in there, but then eventually, you know, Leo Santa Cruz, you know, ended up stepping up there, throwing a little bit more punches than Rivera, and Rivera didn't really have anything that kind of like, you know, threw Santa Cruz off, you know, there. You know, the thing about it is you had Santa Cruz just, you know, outworking him, and he ended up having, according to punch stats, over 1,200 punches thrown over the course of those 12 rounds, and landing about 330 of those punches, you know, while Rivera threw about 800 and then landed around 150 over the course of the 12 rounds. But, you know, he, you know, kind of like just threw a slew of punches, Santa Cruz did, just continued to, you know, come at Rivera. Rivera was, you know, very tough there in the ring, but, you know, nothing really serious to kind of like have either, you know, either fighter in trouble during the course of the fight. But, you know, Rivera just tried to, you know, get in there and try to get to the inside of Santa Cruz and, you know, eventually try to break down Leo Santa Cruz, but, you know, wasn't able to basically do that there. So you had Santa Cruz there get the unanimous decision victory as, you know, three judges scored the bout 119 to 109 for him to retain that WBA title. You know, like I was saying, I think, you know, you had Rivera there get, you know, pretty much a good start on Santa Cruz in the first round, but that was pretty much it. Didn't have much else after that. So Santa Cruz looked like he, you know, basically cruised to that decision victory in order to, you know, improve his record there to 36 wins, one loss, one draw, while, you know, Rivera suffered the third loss of his professional career. And so you have Santa Cruz there, still WBA featherweight champion. You know, overall, you know, I just thought it was a, you know, fight where Santa Cruz, you know, was, you know, very active. That's what he's known to be. But, you know, it was something to the point where, you know, I kind of like said, okay, what am I looking for here with Leo Santa Cruz that kind of like separates himself from the other top featherweights? And here I just, you know, seen the basic same things that I've seen from Leo Santa Cruz and I've seen in many of his fights. Just, you know, come forward style, throw a lot of punches, try to see if he could get his opponent hurt and try to capitalize on that. But, you know, nothing really over the top that says he's, like, hitting shoulders above, you know, the other featherweight guys are out there. You had the thing with, the other champions that are there, Oscar Valdez, Seth Warrington, and Jerry Russell Jr. And, last year you saw Josh Warrington get those key wins over Lee Selby and Carl Frampton, who, were seen as, a couple of the top guys in the featherweight division. And Josh Warrington just outworked Lee Selby and Carl Frampton, in order to win that IBF version of the featherweight title and to, retain that there against Carl Frampton. While you have the WBO champion Oscar Valdez there, undefeated, defeated, Scott Quigg last year, and had like a couple of fights where, maybe he kind of like had a little bit of weaknesses here and there, but you still have to consider him. He's undefeated world champion. And then you have Gary Russell Jr., WBC champion, had his win in 2017 over Oscar Escandon, and then in 2018, defeating Jojo Diaz there in a pretty good fight against a guy that was up and coming, that Golden Boy had a good amount of stock behind to see if he would be able to be a world champion. You had Gary Russell Jr. make those proper adjustments during the course of that fight in order to get the decision win there. So, to me, it's just a matter of seeing where Leo Santa Cruz is in the overall landscape of the featherweight division, or the top of the featherweight division. And, while he may have a valid chance against all three of those other champions, it's just, okay, when is he going to be able to just go ahead and fight these other guys and, try to go for a unification. Yes, he's had his fights against Abner Mares. He's, had this fight here against Rafael Rivera, a couple of fights against Carl Frampton. In that fight against Carl Frampton, he basically got outworked by somebody that was just dead set on, trying to get to the inside of him. And that's how he, ended up losing back in 2016 against Carl Frampton. And then in the rematch, it was just a matter of him trying to change it up, become more active, try to box and keep in range against Frampton for him to get that title back. So, I just, see, Santa Cruz being content with having those, fights against those guys that are, around mid-level in the featherweight division, and, not necessarily going forward with trying to be a unified champion there in the featherweight division. So, while other people are, looking into trying to see, what's next as far as like trying to unify. I mean, we had, talks about Josh Warrington fighting Oscar Valdez, and, Gary Russell Jr., like you said, he rather, try to unify the featherweight. And if he can't do that, then it'll just, move up to the super featherweight division. So, it just seems like Leo Santa Cruz kind of like holds the cards there, so to speak, within the featherweight division. It's just that you got to see if he's going to be willing to step up to fight one of those other champions or not. But, right now I'm not completely confident that Leo Santa Cruz will do that anytime soon. That's what you, basically have there as far as like the overall summary is in reference to Santa Cruz getting this win over
Rafael Rivera. And you know, maybe still there for him in the future. So you know what took place at the Microsoft Theater in the co-feature bout was Omar Figueroa Jr. taking on John Belina Jr. There that was you know, pretty much around the 147-pound division. You had Omar Figueroa Jr., former you know, lightweight champion there, you know, had his wins over the likes of Ricky Burns and Antonio DeMarco, a former world welterweight champion, Robert Carrera, into retirement in 2017, going up against John Molina Jr., of course, who is a, you know, rugged guy, took on the likes of Terrence Crawford, Ruslan Provodnikov, Adrian Broner, Lucas Satife, you know, had his, oh, basically is who's who as far as, like, you know, fighting guys within the lightweight and super lightweight division. With this particular fight, it was like kind of interesting that this matchup was put together. Both of these guys had significant layoffs as that fight between Figueroa and Guerrero happened in the middle of 2017, while Belina also had his last fight in 2017 as well, so there was like nothing really put together for either fighter up until now. And so you had this fight between these two guys, and you know the thing about it is that you know I think he had some type of you know expectation there for Omar Figueroa. But John Molina Jr., you know, while he's, you know, had his share of losses, you know, over the past few years or so, he's a, you know, very rugged fighter, very tough out for, you know, a lot of people. You kind of like seeing that there against Figueroa. And, well, for me, I kind of like thought that Figueroa would be able to kind of like show that he is a guy that could really get after someone like John Molina that, you know, had his, you know, had a lot of miles behind him with the tough fights that he had over the past few years. But here it just seemed like you had Figueroa just really have himself open a good number of times there against John Molina. Of course, a lot of people, you know, who scout John Molina Jr. Seeing that he kind of like tries to go after his opponents, setting things up with his right hand. And, you know, I would have thought that, you know, Omar Figueroa would have, you know, scouted that out, made an adjustment, you know, before the fight. But you just didn't really see that, you know, over the course of this fight here. So, you know, John Molina was able to be game against Figueroa. And then you would just see that John Molina just caught Figueroa a few times. You know, I thought he, you know, had a good little back and forth there in a good amount of those rounds that he had. And, you know, going into that last round, it seemed to be, you know, very close.
You know, maybe it would be something where it would be like a 6-4, six rounds of four type of fight. Either way, and if you're watching on Fox, there it was like, you know, the announcement was taking a while for that decision to come through, and you know, a couple of the commentators out there thought it would be a instance where you would have a scorecard of 96-94, but you know, when the announcement came through, you had, you know, scores of 97-93, 98-92, and 99-91, all for Umar Figueroa Jr. So he gave him the decision. It goes to 28 wins, 0 losses, and 1 draw. And you have Molina there with the record of 30 wins and 8 losses. And, you know, after those scorecards, you know, came down, the people that were in attendance, you know, kind of took offense to that type of decision, and, you know, had a couple of boos out there going towards the judges and, you know, having Figueroa win that, you know, basically win the fight with that significant margin. So you have Figueroa there pretty much in the welterweight division, floating around that welterweight, junior welterweight division. Like I said, he's still undefeated, but really not seeing him as far as like a contender there at welterweight, since he had been inactive for over a year before this fight took place. So, you know, maybe, you know, they had this decision here, seeing if they could, you know, open him up for more opportunities in the welterweight division. I mean, considering that he had that win over Robert Guerrero in 2017, but, you know, wasn't able to, you know, build off that to, you know, get another fight at welterweight for that amount of time. So you got to see what's next out there for him. You know, maybe PBC will try to have something set up for that to happen, kind of like put him in there. I'm going to say within the next 6 months or so, he needs to, you know, be able to get back in there and, you know, try to get himself as far as like being in contender for the welterweight division. But, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, trying to make something up there for him to see what's next. That's out there. Next thing that I wanted to, you know, try to knock down is the fights that took place on Friday night. You had a Top Rank on ESPN with the main event being Rob Brandt versus Kasan Basengura for the WBA middleweight title. You have Rob Brandt having his first defense of that title after defeating Ryota Murata back in October of 2018. Kasan Basengura, you know, coming from Ukraine, was undefeated at the time, 17-0, basically stepping up to fight Rob Brandt over in, you know, Minnesota there. You know, I would just say this was just something to get Rob Brandt in the ring to defend that title, you know, pretty much near his hometown, get hometown support out there for him. And this is what we had. You had Rob Brandt being there. You saw the amount of activity that he had in his fight against Ryota Murata, where Brandt threw over 1,200 punches in that particular fight. So here against, you know, Basengura, you have pretty much the same type of approach that you had in the fight against Ryota Murata. You had the thing with Rob Brandt kind of being very active, going pretty much going after his opponent over and over. Basinkarov, you know, tried to see if he could, you know, defend against that, but we didn't necessarily see that there from him pretty much in the first couple of rounds. The first knockdown took place in the second round there with Basinkarov, and he was able to, you know, get up from that, but just didn't have much of anything else there for Rob Brandt over the course of the fight. And Brandt just continued to go after him, was able to, you know, damage Basinkarov's nose over the course of that fight. And then, you know, had another knockdown in the 11th round and was able to just go off from that particular momentum to go after his opponent yet again. And then the referee stepped in, Mark Nelson stepped in to get a stoppage of that particular fight for Rob Brandt to get the win and retain that WBA middleweight title. So he stays, he keeps that WBA title, goes to 25-1, and, you know, pretty much looks to see what else is out there for the middleweight division. There's going to be a lot of activity out there, of course, with Canelo Alvarez facing Daniel Jacobs later this year. And we got to see what happens with the other top middleweight contenders that are out there, you know, including the champion there for the WBO and Demetrius Andrade. And you got to see what Gennady Golovkin does here in the near future. So that's what we have there. Real quick, we got like a couple of callers in here, but first we got Eric Code 205. What's going on with you?
Hey, what's going on, James? It's Mike Brady.
Hey there, brother Mike, man. How's your weekend been going?
I was going well, man. Just a nice, relaxing weekend. Been kind of getting it in at work, and I just needed just a sit down weekend, to be real. So I ain't been nothing this weekend for real.
True, true. So, you know, we had like a little bit of action on Friday and Saturday with the fights that were on ESPN and also the PBC on Fox that I just went through. So is there either one of them that you wanted to, you know, talk about a little bit?
I saw some of the Figueroa-John Molina fight. And, I mean, we already knew what it was going to be in terms of it was going to be an action-packed fight. And both of those guys put their heart into every fight that they're in. So I have a lot of respect for people like that. But at the same token, I don't see either one of those guys, especially Figueroa, lasting too much longer. It's unfortunate. Like, you know, you can already tell John Molina kind of on the tail end of his career just because the way he fights. But I don't think Figueroa is going to last too much longer if those are his continued stylistic fights, which that is his style, you know. He's very talented, but, yeah, I mean, it's like Ruslan Provodnikov. I'm pretty sure he's probably pissing blood now. You know, it's just sad, but I mean, that's the way people fight, and, you know, they put their heart into it, but I don't see him lasting too much longer. In terms of the main event, the guy, I forgot his name, what's the guy in the main event outside of Leo Santa Cruz? What was the other guy's name?
Who Santa Cruz fought?
Yeah.
Rafael Rivera.
Rivera, how many losses, or was he undefeated?
Nah, you know, Rivera had about a couple losses before going into his fight with Santa Cruz.
Okay, so Rivera, maybe stylistically, he fought like better fighters, but the dude seemed pretty he seemed pretty good to me. Like, I mean, Santa Cruz obviously was a different level of talent than him, but it was a competitive one-sided fight, I'll say that. It was competitive, like, the dude belonged, but Santa Cruz is just better and longer, you know. But the other guy, I could see him giving other people trouble. Like, I think they're definitely going to bring him back and like, challenge titles. And against the right wrong person, he might win the title.
Yeah. Well, the thing with Rivera is that, you know, he just couldn't, you know, throw anything that could have Santa Cruz respect him out there. So, you know, the thing about it is that if you can't nullify the activity of real Santa Cruz, then he's just going to keep coming after you and coming after you and not necessarily, you know, try to, you know, stop his whole thing there. So, with Rafael Rivera, I mean, he just has to, you know, keep working and then try to work on, I'd say, either his power a little bit or try to, you know, have a, something where he could establish a counter game and then be able to capitalize on mistakes there from his opponent. But, you know, in the case of Leo Santa Cruz, I mean, he was, you know, able to do his little activity and things like that, but he wasn't able to take out a guy there in Rafael Rivera where he was, you know, kind of like coming in on short notice, you know, after, you know, a few weeks' notice, you know, since, you know, the original opponent, Miguel Flores, had to pull out due to injury there. So, you know, my thing is that, you know, how would Santa Cruz perform against the likes of the other champions like Oscar Valdez, Josh Warrington, and Gary Russell Jr.? And I'm not certain if, you know, those guys are pretty much good matchups there for him. I mean, he was able to be outworked by Carl Frampton, who, you know, Josh Warrington ended up beating last year. So if he... So if Santa Cruz, you know, walked into a match with Josh Warrington, I'm unsure, you know, how he would fare against a guy like that. I mean, got like another caller in here, area code 813. What's going on? You're on the Boxing Source Radio Show.
Hey, what's up, guys? This is Joel calling from Tampa. What's up, Mike? Once again, happy birthday to you, bro.
Appreciate it, Terrell. Appreciate it.
Hey, yeah, just real quick, just to follow up on what you guys talked about, and particularly with what Mike said on like figuring out people like that not being able to last too much longer with that particular style. I was actually watching a video this week where Mayweather was talking to Devin Haney in the ring, just kind of giving some instruction and just speaking on the fact of how do you last long in this sport. And obviously, we know Mayweather's been doing it, what, 18 plus years, whatever it is. And all while doing that, when possible, right? And we look at people like the Figueroa, stuff like that, Leo Santa Cruz, and just look at the Mexican style, which is pretty much a Rocky Sock'em brawl type style. Not necessarily great on defense, but just getting your punch output out there like that. And like Mike said, when you employ that style, it's a chance, like you alluded to, Wilson Provodnikov, not last long in the sport. Just your body's just not built to take that type of damage on that type of level over the appearance, the same amount of time. So that's going to shorten your career in boxing. And I see with Leo Santa Cruz, and has always been one of my favorite fighters out there because of his high work rate and stuff like that. But I tell you what, if Leo Santa Cruz somehow has some more power, this guy would be elite. For this day and age, for this era, he's a good fighter. He's a great fighter for this day and age. But if he had more power, he would definitely be elite. and could definitely get a lot of people out of there. Because, like, even in this fight against Rivera, I fully well expected for that fight to go about 6 to 8 rounds, something like that, and just because of the different class, right? And considering the fact that Rivera has lost 2 of his last 3 fights on top of that, right? It wasn't by nothing. I think once by a split decision, another by unanimous decision, something like that. But nevertheless, he lost 2 of his last 3. So I just thought that Santa Cruz would get him out of there, but that wasn't the case. And just once again, there's just a lot of cases within this fight where they just simply just went at it. And one round, I forget what's round in particular, but at the end of the round, they just went at it literally rock and stopping robots type style. And it was amazing to watch. But if Santa Cruz had more power, he would definitely be an elite fighter. Right now, he's just a great fighter. I mean, I admire him for some time. Even like you said, James Junior, Warrington, people like that. You can't decidedly give him an edge over you, either one of those people. But once again, like what Mabel alluded to, if you take little damage over the course of your career, the better you are of elongating your career. That's certainly not the case with Leo Santa Cruz, even though he's been in the game for quite some time. But it was a good fight. Good fight.
Yeah, the thing there with that Santa Cruz Rivera fight was, you know, a lot of back and forth. Action between the two. It was just that, you know, the difference with Santa Cruz was that he threw like a couple more punches in comparison to Rivera, while, you know, Rivera was just, you know, trying to be focused and get to the inside there a little bit. But Rivera was, you know, very tough guy there in the ring to, you know, take the punches from Leo Santa Cruz there over the course of 12 rounds and get to the end of that particular fight. It's just that, you know, for me, I kind of like expected to, you know, Santa Cruz to eventually take out Rivera out there, and it just didn't necessarily happen. So kind of like, you know, putting a question as far as like, you know, how he would fare against the likes of a Josh Warrington, who defeated Carl Frampton, like I said, and Oscar Valdez and Gary Russell Jr. So I was like, you know, okay, when are we going to see Leo Santa Cruz go against, you know, guys of that level? Because he's, you know, been there as that featherweight champion. But, you know, after the Carl Frampton fights, he really hasn't kind of like stepped up there in competition. So I kind of like, you know, put that in the question there for Leo Santa Cruz to see if he's, you know, able to step up here later in his career. What about that co-feature bout there, that Omar Figueroa Jr. versus John Molina Jr., and how the decision came out to be pretty much a blowout decision?
And I didn't get to see that one, so I'll allow you guys for that.
All right.
So in terms of the decision, I didn't listen to the commentary. I don't know who it was who knew John Molina, but I know it was one of the guys who knew John Molina and had dealt with him before. So I couldn't say that he had a bias, but I heard one of the boxing people mention it, that he could have had a bias, which is why he was talking, you know, like up. And so, okay, so I did watch the last few rounds. So I saw the match on the YouTube, and so the first 6 rounds, it was probably like a foreign telecast, and then the last three or four rounds, it was you know, like the normal PBC telecast. And so then every time Molina did something, the guy was like, "Oh, look at Molina, 3 punches." And then Lennox Lewis had said something like, "You know, well, you know, he's landing, but he ain't landing really clean. He ain't landing flush. Like his head ain't getting knocked back." Kind of like how Tyson Fury was landing some clean punches on Deontay Wilder, like knocking his head back sort of. Like he wasn't landing flush like that. Or how Errol Spence was landing on somebody. I forgot who he was landing on, but he just kept popping whoever head back. I forgot who it was, but actually that's maybe all of Errol Spence fights he does that to people. But yeah, so I could see what Lennox Lewis was talking about. The dude, he was landing, he wasn't landing like clean because Figueroa, even though his defense isn't great, he does kind of roll with punches, and he gets hit with the first punch, but then he always dips or, like, rolls his shoulders and come under. He always does something else to try not to get hit by the second punch. But, I mean, he always get hit by the first punch. But from me, not, like, hearing the telecast or the broadcasters, I could see how it was a decision for Figueroa because, like, even though John Molina was doing his thing, I think that Figueroa, and I might be mixing fights. Yeah, never mind. I think I'm mixing the Leo Santa Cruz. But Leo Santa Cruz was having a lot of success when he kept the dude on the outside, and then he was just pretty much jabbing and then just picking the dude off. I mean, it was a competitive fight, I will say that, but there were times where I felt like Figueroa did more, or definitely Figueroa landed all the flurries at the end of the round. I saw that. And then, so let's say if the middle of the round was even and then Figueroa landed the flurry at the end of the round, you could make the case for giving him the round, but it wasn't. I didn't feel like Figueroa didn't win. I thought it was competitive, but, yeah. I mean, I wasn't watching, like, super, super closely. I will say that, too. Yeah.
The guy that they had on Fox, they had, like, Larry Hazard Sr. There scoring the bout, and he had actually had Molina winning that bout. And so did ESPN have Molina winning that bout. I think they, just saw the more significant type of punches being landed by Molina, even though it may have seemed that Figueroa had, rolled with the punches or partially blocked the punches, specifically the power punches that were coming to him. They had Molina looking like he was a little bit more active as far as, like, punch output, but Figueroa seemed to score more of the landed punches. But it just didn't seem like it was something where it would be, overwhelmingly a Figueroa fight. So that's why I, like, kind of seen at the scorecards kind of be, like, wide for, two of those scorecards, given Figueroa eight rounds of the 10 and another one giving them all but one round. So I was like, why would they, have that, type of scorecard when the actual fight was much closer than that? So, I mean, for me, it just showed that Figueroa still has, like, a little bit of work to do. His last fight was, over a year ago against Robert Guerrero, and he looked good against Robert Guerrero, but Guerrero was on the downturn of his career, and that ended up being Guerrero's last fight. So he just still has to, adjust and see if he could get something back, try to be more active and see if he could be some type of contender there in the welterweight division, because that division is very deep. And, while they have, a couple of guys competing there at the top, you got to see if Omar Figueroa could, try to get his name in there by getting a couple of, mid-level or some fights with known guys to see if he could just, put his name in the hat as far as, like, contending for one of those titles instead of, just sitting back and waiting to see if there's, like, anything available for him there in the welterweight division. That's what he got from there. Still have about a few minutes left in the live session here. For those who want to give their take on boxing, you can call in at 347-237-5539. Just looking ahead here, on Saturday, February 23rd, we have, a fight coming up. It's going to be at the O2 Arena, and it will be shown on Showtime, but also on ITV Box Office. The super middleweight title will be on the line between James DeGale and Chris Eubank Jr. Of course, You had James Segel there, being a former super middleweight title or super middleweight champion, had the IBF title once before, and lost it to Caleb Truax in 2017 before winning it back in 2018. Eventually vacated it. And then on the other side, you got Chris Eubank Jr. That was part of the World Boxing Super Series there at super middleweight. Defeated Avni Yildirim before losing to George Groves in the semifinals. And then had a fight in the undercard of the finals before, getting something put together for him to fight James Segel. It was just that no one really knew for sure that those two guys were fighting until the turn of 2019. So they have it here, Osa Arena in Greenwich. So just seeing where both of these guys are in the overall scope of the super middleweight division. For me, with Eubank Jr., I kind of like had expectations of him in the World Boxing Super Series, thinking that he would, probably get to the final of that World Boxing Super Series, but ended up losing to George Groves, where he was fairly one-dimensional for a majority of that particular fight, and that's why he ended up losing that fight by unanimous decision. While James Segel did get outworked in his first fight against Caleb Truax, but was able to pull off the win there in the rematch that was at the Hard Rock in Las Vegas. So this is, to me, it's kind of like a toss-up fight because, I mean, I'm not sure if Segel is, with the downside of his career, and Eubank Jr., sometimes it looks like he finds a way to, either underperform in some of his wins or lose to, a guy that he really shouldn't be losing to. So, that's the initial things I have here coming up for this particular fight. Let's start with Mike Grady. What are you seeing here between these two guys coming up on Saturday?
I was listening, but I wasn't listening. So Chris Eubank and James Segel?
Yep.
And they haven't fought before, right?
Nope.
So, James Segel, his win, he has shown that his win isn't great anymore, right? Like, he can't sustain it. His, herky-jerky, keeping people off of him style and continuing to move. That is what he has shown. Like, he can't keep that up anymore, right?
Yeah, at times, but it just depends on how much pressure is being put on him. Like, Badu Jack and Caleb Truax were able to do that against him, and he ended up fading in the, down the stretch in those fights when it got to the end. So it's just a matter of him being, broken down a little bit. People, get on the inside against him.
All right, so with that being said, I think that even though what's his name again? What's the other
Chris
guy?
Eubank.
I forgot his name. Even though Chris Eubank loads up on punches and misses and probably don't hit people, he's able to do that for 12 rounds or at least most of the 12 rounds. And so the fact that I don't know. I might take it back. James Segel might be able to keep him off of him because the fact that Eubank does throw the big punches. Like, if Eubank did, a consistent body shot, then threw the big punches, then it would be a different story. But the fact that he only just throws hooks, and people are, most of the time, 85% of the time, they can see that stuff. 80% of the time, they can see it. So I think if he throw body shots, then he could wear Segel down. But if he don't, then Segel should be able to keep him off of him with just a jab or whatever.
Yeah, it's just a matter of seeing what Eubank Jr. does. I mean, I got to, see, if he still is rolling with his father as far as, being his main trainer, and then you know, seeing if he could just make adjustments to, you know, go after James Aguil, you know, early and then break him down and then see if he could go to the top late out there. So, you know, that's what I'm initially looking for there with, you know, Chris Eubank. Terrell, what do you got on this fight coming up on Saturday?
Yeah, this is an interesting fight for a good number of reasons. First of all, it's a lot of bad blood between the two fights, despite the fact that they haven't fought before. But your classic press kit, stuff like that. They're getting ready to rumble at the press or whatever. So it's a bit of a brush match. They're both from the UK. We all know about pretty much Chris Eubank Jr., son of a great UK fighter himself, but at the same time, we probably would accurately label him a B-level fighter, because in those just a few times that he should have stepped up and grabbed an opportunity like against George Rose, he failed. So he's never had that signature win. You know, he does have a name which likely built from his father. And even a couple years ago when he was supposed to fight Triple G, that fight didn't come to fruition, and Debbie took some criticism as a result of that fight not happening. And even with the Gil, we know about him, his recent war with, a few years ago when he beat Darrell, took his belt, and then going from that point, had that battle with Badu Jack and won that fight. But it's kind of funny because he had the belt, I think he had the better, and he basically cited the fact that he wanted to bigger fights towards the last leg of his career. And even in his fight now, with going against Chris Eubank Jr., he's kind of alluded to the fact that he may retire in the event that he may take a loss. It's kind of like, well, why would you kind of put that out there before the fight? It's kind of curious. It's almost like, are you planning on losing? Of course it's not, but it's kind of, he kind of put that out there. So, I mean, it's going to be a good fight. It's going to be a good scrap, you know. So we're going to see once again if Eubank Jr. can step up and get a signature win within his career, or it's going to be relegated to be a B-level fighter. So it's going to be good.
Yeah, you know, with Eubank Jr., they like still had like a lot of expectations from him there in the super middleweight division. But yeah, that George Groves kind of like that fight kind of like told a lot with him, you know, being one dimensional number one, and then seeing how, you know, George Groves was, you know, taken out the way he was against Callum Smith to, you know, kind of like, I would say put Eubank a couple of steps down there in the super middleweight division. So for me, I kind of like see him, you know, seeing if he could go up against James Aguil and try to wear him down, because you had, you know, DeGale is pretty much the guy that is the one of the older guys out there in the super middleweight division, and, you know, been in a few, you know, few tough fights. So his mileage would be, you know, a lot more than what Chris Eubank has. So, you know, kind of like, you know, expect Eubank to, you know, try to get this win over James Aguil. But if he doesn't, then that would be a significant deterrent there for Chris Eubank. And you probably wouldn't really see Eubank really contending for one of the top spots at super middleweight for a good while if he ends up losing to James Aguil, and he probably won't be, you know, set up for those type of fights for a while. He'll probably just get, you know, some, you know, a few mid-grade fights over in the UK before he's able to get another one of those shots. That's what I'm looking at for this particular matchup that's going to be on Showtime during the afternoon on Saturday. We also have, you know, there within that particular division, Anthony Durrell going up against Avni Yildirim for the vacant WBC super middleweight title. This title was, you know, given up by David Benavidez due to Benavidez's positive test for, you know, legal substances that, you know, kind of like was brought up by Caleb Plant the other day, which was kind of funny. But you have Anthony Durrell there that, you know, has been, you know, like, you know, like I was saying, has been a former WBC super middleweight title holder. And, you know, just had his, you know, share of fights, trying to get on back on the winning streak, you know, after losing that title to Battle Jack in 2015. So he gets his opportunity to get that title back against Avenue Yildirim, who, you know, was, like I said, part of that tournament against Chris Eubank, but got taken out, you know, within three rounds by Chris Eubank Jr., but then turned around and had a winning streak of his own, building himself up in the WBC rankings to get to this position. So you're going to have Durrell taking on Yildirim here. And for me, I just think that, you know, with Yildirim, this is going to be just a, you know, a significant step up for him against Anthony Durrell. I think Durrell is going to outwork him and, you know, eventually break him down and probably get a stoppage victory to win that WBC super middleweight title, so that, you know, Durrell could probably, you know, put himself in position to, you know, try to go after, you know, the other world title holders in that division, including the, you know, newly crowned IBF champion Caleb Plant there, who, you know, ended up defeating Usyk Gouye a few weeks ago. So that's what I got on that one. Let's start with Terrell. What are you looking forward to with Durrell and Yildirim?
Well, I mean, you know, the jury's already out on Durrell, because you can kind of look at Durrell, who had a bet at one point, had high aspirations for this year, but just kind of fizzled out, and kind of the MO him is like he doesn't have that championship level heart, you know, as we saw when even back when, I think that was Carl Falky fought in the tournament way back when, and even going forward to DeGale, you know, just into that heart that you want to see out of a championship level fighter. It's up to him, because you can kind of look at him. Now, granted, he's older than Eubank Jr., but you can kind of parallel their effort in the ring, you know. And it's funny because they have all the physical tools, good size, good power, stuff like that. You know, they have the tools, but the thing about it, do they have the heart to go carry on to a championship level? And so that's real happy couple things. Lost it, and now he's back in line. You know, that's how it is now. You lose, get back in line, and hopefully you take a physical loss that will really just derail your mental state, things like that. So it's up to him.
Yeah, you know, with the thing with Durrell here, he did have his, you know, a couple of fights that, you know, taking on like the likes of Caleb Truax, Saki Obika, and Battle Jack. And, you know, after that loss to Battle Jack, you kind of like seen him, you know, try to see if he could, you know, work his way back up in that super middleweight division. So, he was looking to, you know, try to get himself back in and get that next opportunity for a world title. So he gets it here against Avenue Yildirim. I mean, I think, you know, they were probably trying to set him up for that title shot against David Benavidez. But with Benavidez, you know, getting tested positive and that title being stripped from him, that fight fell through. So they just, you know, kept Durrell there in that particular position in order to, you know, fight for the world title against Avenue Yildirim, who, like I said, was building his way back up to try to get to one of those top spots in the WBC rankings. So I think it'll be, you know, like I said, it'll probably be a pretty good fight, you know, for the first couple of rounds. But I just expect, you know, Durrell to outwork Yildirim later on, probably around like round five or six there for this one. Mike Radio. What do you got on this?
On Darrell? I don't think I watched the guy who he's fighting, so I can't really speak on what's going to happen. But I think Darrell on the tail end of his career. And this is the Darrell that got beat by Uz Kataguri, right?
No, this is a brother.
Oh, this the better one.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, how long he been out of curiosity?
No, the thing with Darrell, he kind of like had his last fight in El Paso. It wasn't like a very impressive type of fight that they had, Darrell against Abraham Ham, but he was able to get like a clear decision against him, and this is like that Abraham Ham was the guy that like fought Jay Leon Love to a draw, where like a lot of people thought that Ham won that particular fight, so Darrell was able to clearly defeat Abraham Ham before trying to get himself in position to fight for the WBC super middleweight title.
Okay, yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it, to see how he does and see where he at. So this Darrell is at which weight division? 160?
This is 168.
Oh, 168, gotcha. Yep, I'm looking forward to see to see the fight, I guess. I don't really have no comments on it though.
Yeah, gotcha. I'm gonna just keep my eye on this particular fight. I'll be on Fox Sports 1, so I'll be able to see what happens with that. If Darrell gets the win, then they'll probably set him up, like I said, against likes of Caleb Plant. Even though Caleb Plant kind of was talking about possibly fighting Jose Benavidez in the future if what happens with Benavidez after his, suspension gets lifted. So, that's my expectation off of that.
Benavidez will make sense if he got a title, right?
Well, with Plant and Benavidez?
Yeah, that would make more sense if he got a title, right?
Yeah, I mean, it would, but I don't know if they're going to, have – Benavidez try to win that WBC title back after this fight takes place. Maybe they would have, Benavidez going up against Plant probably first before he faces the winner of this particular fight. But he just got to see, what happens with Benavidez if they're going to, just put him in a pretty much like in a get-back fight first before contending for the WBC or the IBF super middleweight title next. So that's what we, have there for Benavidez first. But, coming up next week, I just expect Anthony Darrell to, get this win over Yo Durham and then try to see if he could get a unification or just defend that WBC title couple of times before going for unification. With that, that pretty much like covers everything here for this particular week. You have the formal announcement for the unified heavyweight title fight between Anthony Joshua and Jarrell Miller. They're going to have the press conference on Tuesday in Madison Square Garden. See if I'm be able to catch that. Go up there to New York and see how that press conference goes. They already had pre-sale tickets for that, and soon they'll be available to the general public on Ticketmaster there. After pre-sale, and probably get a couple of updates as far as like other matchups that are supposed to be taking place later on this year. So I'll be on the lookout for that over the course of this week as well. But And with that, bringing an end to this particular episode of Boxing
well,
Source
I got
Radio
I got
Show.
Something to speak on that before you bring it to an end, JR. All
right, hold. Oh, what you got?
So we see that the reports say that Joshua has set the pre-sale record for the Madison Square Garden. Do you think that's like a amazing feat, or is that just a shocking coincidence?
I mean, to me, the pre-sale record is just something in reference to, you know, monetary, you know, sales. It's nothing as far as, like, you know, overall seats or something like that. Because,
yeah.
You know, the previous record, I think the previous record they said was for the Gennady Golovkin fight that he had against, you know, who is the guy, David Lemieux. You know, prices for Golovkin and Lemieux will be like on a whole different thing from what you have here with Anthony Joshua and Jarrell Miller. So, I mean, I definitely didn't have, you know, that Golovkin and Lemieux fight having tickets, you know, the cheapest tickets being $250, just like this particular fight is. You know, so they probably had it, I think they had it like, you know, $50, $75, $100, and then working up to $1,000. While this one has it from like $250 to, you know, $2,500, $5,000 for ringside seats. So, you know, while they may have like, you know, had the thing for an MSG record, you know, those ticket prices were, you know, big. So it's like, okay, if they're able to, you know, get people to buy those tickets, then I guess that, you know, that's where they get that whole record thing from. But it's nothing as far as, like, you know, it may not be, like, for overall seating is concerned. It's just the, you know, the way that the price point is. So, say, okay, this thing had a pre-sale that generated this amount of money, which is more than, you know, anything they've had at MSG. So that's pretty much where that comes from.
So my thing is, we saw that Anthony Joshua was selling all these pre-sale records in the UK before they put the whole you can't buy these, you know, you can't do these resale ticket things. And so now, since there's a pre-sale, he's breaking records again in terms of, you know, pre-sale, blah, blah, blah. But it ain't hard to see or speculate that they buy the tickets and then they put them on StubHub or something and they just make a profit off of them.
Well, that actually can't be necessarily proven, though, because the thing about it is that with many of these events, not just the thing with, you know, like Anthony Joshua event, but many of these other events have had, like, pre-sales where they end up being resold, too. So, I mean, you can't, like, necessarily target it to just Anthony Joshua because it's happened in other avenues as well. I mean, just for, you know, a direct example, yeah, Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. Like, who was able to access those tickets, you know, ahead of time and then turn around and resell them, you see? So it's like, okay, you have this fight that's available, pretty much would be available to the public in this particular instance. But when it came to Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao, like, what public, you know, general public was able to get access to buy tickets for that particular fight before they were resold? Not very many people at all. So
that's all well and great to speak on Floyd and Manny Pacquiao, which may very well be true. But what I'm saying is, this whole notion of someone, you know, the ticket being sold out in so many minutes is likely bogus, because it's probably money set aside to reserve a set number of tickets and then make a profit off of them, which is smart, but, you know, that seems like their model. So I just think it's kind of screwy that, you know, that you know, I get it. You tell a picture, oh, he's a cash cow, but I think it's a bit screwy to you know, it's like data manipulation. Sort of.
I mean, there has been, you know, kind of like speculation with you know, those fights. But the thing about it is that, you know, you can't
you can't, like, really, you know, say that they doctor up the amount of purses that, you know, the fighter gets from the ticket sales, because it comes from, you know, that it comes from sponsorships and everything that is related to the fighter. So they're going to have to, you know, be able to explain all of that, you know, with the purses that, you know, somebody like Anthony Joshua or, you know, another high profile fighter gets. So it's not like, okay, you could say, okay, this gets this amount, but you say it's, you know, sold over StubHub. You could say that with just about anybody now. You could say that with, you know, Canelo Alvarez or, you know, somebody else that's, you know, around that level. So, I mean, the thing with Anthony Joshua is, if you're able to have, like, say, have someone or some company buy out those tickets and then resell them, I mean, that happens, actually, that, you know, not just necessarily happens in boxing, but that happens in other sports as well. So, if you have, like, a quick example, the Super Bowl, like, none of those tickets for a Super Bowl in any year are pretty much, like, available to the general public. They're mainly bought out by corporations that resell them. So, the thing about it is that you have the same thing here. As far as, like say, corporations within the UK and the US have those tickets and they buy those tickets and then resell them or use them as part as packages to, you know, like say, okay, you get tickets, you get hotel, you get accommodations and the like. So that's pretty much like how that whole thing works.
Okay.
All right, Terrell, you got anything here before we roll out?
No, just real quick. I'm looking forward to this the press conference for Miller and Joshua. It's going to be very animated because you've got two different sides, with Joshua, the more reserved side, where as soon as the fight was announced, Miller was just out making videos and statements. This is a bit outrageous, so it's going to be interesting in that aspect to see if Miller can draw Joshua out and get him out of character, in a sense. You know, so it's going to be interesting for that.
Yeah, of course, you know, we have Drill Miller has been, you know, very outspoken for the majority of his professional career, you know, talking about, you know, a lot of guys within his division, and Anthony Joshua is, you know, no different. So he has, you know, nothing to really hold back as far as, like, trash talk for Anthony Joshua, you know, given the memes that he's put out and, you know, videos, like you said, that he's, you know, posted. So, you know, come Tuesday, we'll see what happens with this first particular press conference, and then they'll have something else later on down the line over in London there between these two. So, you know, I'm kind of like expecting, you know, a little bit of fireworks here and there to see, you know, what happens as far as, like, if Joel Miller could push the right buttons to trigger off Anthony Joshua, you know, kind of like what happened, what was it, let's say around like September of last year, pretty much like July, August, September of last year when they had like a press conference and Jerome Miller crashed the press conference and was talking junk and then Anthony Joshua said something back to him. So pretty much kind of like seeing something like that happening on Tuesday afternoon over in the press conference in Madison Square Garden. So that's what I'm looking for. So with that, that puts the end to this episode of the Boxing Source Radio Show. Catch the next one. That's going to be next Sunday. You know, you can catch the sister shows on the Golong Media Channel on Blog Talk Radio, including the Cold Hard Truth on Sports and Take the Cell. Like I say, at the end of every show, Point of Boxing is a hit, and I can hit, not the standing trade. On that note, I'm out. Have a good evening, everybody.
Yep.